The first case on the panel's oral argument agenda for today, I'm going to mispronounce the name of the appellant, Hamza Zalyal.
Zalyal.
Case number 83334 versus State. Are you ready to proceed then, counsel, with your argument?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead and proceed.
I could respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal by my colleague, Ms. Hellman.
Okay.
I'd like to thank the court for allowing us to be here today to argue what I believe are very important issues that I think exist with regards to gaps in within the statutory scheme regarding juvenile justice and the applicability of those statutes to individuals who are no longer juveniles. I think the most important question that's before your honors today is essentially, did the district court in this case err in denying a motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction when the appellant was age 14 at the time of an offense, when the state voluntarily waited over 7 years before issuing an arrest warrant and capturing the defendant, thereby creating a situation where that defendant was captured after age 22 and subsequently charging him as an adult for a charge or a case that would have existed in the juvenile justice system exclusively and should have existed in the juvenile justice system exclusively. In this particular case, there are a variety of statutes that I think apply to this situation. NRS 62A-03A does define a child as a person who's under 18 years of age or who's less than 21 years of age who's subject to the jurisdiction. Moving down the line, the exercise of discretion statute, NRS 62B.300, gives the court, the juvenile court system, the ability to exercise jurisdiction in all proceedings conducted pursuant to that particular title, NRS 62A through H, respectively. 310 indicates it's situations where the court exercises that jurisdiction and indicates that no other court may exercise jurisdiction once the juvenile court has that jurisdiction unless there's a certification of the child for proper criminal proceedings as an adult or they transfer that case to another court pursuant to the provisions of the title. The important one that's addressed by both parties is NRS 62B330. And that discusses when, that discusses specifically that the juvenile court has exclusive jurisdiction over a child who is alleged to or is adjudicated to have committed a delinquent act. I don't think that there is any question as to whether or not this particular act could be defined as a crime or as a delinquent act. And the reason that that's important is the allegations, and I think the state would concede, and everybody's conceded, is that this act occurs at the age of 14 or below. That's important because a delinquent act, or what is not a delinquent act, is defined in 62B330 subsection 3. This is a statute that carries over into 335 that talks about a Category A or B felony arising out of the same facts as a Category A or B felony, regardless of the nature of the offense, if the person was at least 16 years of age but less than 18 years of age when the offense was committed. And that's the trigger language that I think is important when we're looking at, because that language makes it clear that an offense at 16, 17, or 18 that is an A or B felony is not a delinquent act, but one that exists before then is a delinquent act. There's also another trigger, and the person is not identified by law enforcement as having committed the offense and charged before the person is at least 20 years, 3 months of age, but less than 21 years of age, or the person is not identified by law enforcement as having committed the offense until it reaches 21 years of age. Those two connectors do not apply in a situation where the person was not at least 16 years of age. I think that that is especially clear in a case like this, because we're dealing with a 14-year-old. And that seems to be a very clear recitation of legislative intent that a crime committed by an individual, or it's not even a crime, that an act committed by an individual under the age of 16 is a delinquent act. What's very important in a case like this is that when an individual is alleged to have committed a delinquent act and treated as a juvenile, there are a whole series of different rights and privileges that exist, and there are also other rights that are removed from the defendant. So, for example, a juvenile, an accused delinquent, doesn't have a right to a jury trial, doesn't have the right to a speedy and public trial, doesn't have a right to bail. When it comes to whether or not you're sentencing, or you're determining whether somebody should be held, there's a 10-prong test that exists. There's a strong preferential treatment in incarcerating a juvenile, not incarcerating a juvenile, but putting them with their parents. And in the event that he is going to be held, there are a series of risk assessments, mental health screenings, and prongs that must be met in order for that to occur. Additionally, under NRS 62E.010, adjudication of a delinquent act is not a conviction. It's very clear. That's what it says in this particular circumstance. Now, if it's assuming that a defendant is held in custody, or a juvenile defendant is held in custody as a result of placement in a state facility, there are certain restrictions that exist on the ages of people that individual can be held with and the amount of time that incarceration would break. There are registration requirements for an individual who's 14 years of age. However, those can be petitioned to be removed immediately and petitioned again at age 21. At age 30, there is a discretionary petition that can be granted by the court to seal the record. Those are the rights that are offered to a juvenile. However, an individual charged with sexual assault of a minor, when they are elevated to adult court, faces life without the possibility of parole until age 35. So in this instance, we have a case where the state of Nevada, or the government, law enforcement, admittedly knows about a delinquent act, investigates the delinquent act, determines that he's the suspect for the delinquent act, makes the decision to hold off since he's left the country. He returns through a lawful port. Had they issued a warrant or a writ out of juvenile court, when he returns to the United States in a lawful port of entry, he would be arrested and picked up on this warrant, but they don't. 6 years later, they reopen the investigation and issue a warrant. But now, or 7 years later, now he's at the end of his 21st year of age, rolls over to 22, he's arrested and charged. I would pose that the statutes are clear and can be read in a clear fashion that indicates that jurisdiction exists exclusively in juvenile court for delinquent acts, and at the time that that individual moves past the age of 21 years of age, he does not become an adult defendant, but jurisdiction lapses entirely. As a basis, I would turn your honors to the case of Kent versus United States, which is a United States Supreme Court case from 1966. It's referenced in our brief. In Kent versus United States, it talks about a situation in the District of Columbia where there's a process set forth for juvenile justice and waivers of juvenile jurisdiction. In that particular case, juvenile jurisdiction is ordered waived, and the defendant is convicted as an adult. He's alleged to have committed the crime when he was 16 years of age, and then appeals. By the time it gets up to the appellate court and the Supreme Court of the United States, he is now past 21 years of age. In that court, in that case, the same policies that exist there are discussed very thoroughly in Kent versus the United States. Specifically, they say, there's no place in our system of law for reaching a result of such a tremendous consequence, talking about elevating a child issue to an adult issue, without a statement of reasons. And it is inconceivable that a court of justice dealing with adults with respect to a similar issue would proceed in a manner such as this. They go on to discuss the juvenile policies are rooted in social welfare. They're civil, not criminal. The court is engaged in determining the needs of the child, the needs of society. Adjudicating criminal conduct is not the primary purpose. The objectives are to provide measures of guidance and rehabilitation. That the state is essentially acting as a parent's patriot rather than a prosecuting attorney. The admonition to function as a parental relationship. And because the state is supposed to proceed in that circumstance and not as an adversary, the courts rely on that quasi-civil nature of a juvenile proceeding. In this particular case, similar to Nevada, the juvenile court is vested with original and exclusive jurisdiction.
Counsel, why wasn't any of this litigated before a plea was entered? And how could a client be reasonably advised that a plea in these circumstances under existing Nevada law, under the terms of the plea agreement, would be under contract principles that a judge would have to follow it? That's contrary to all the law, whatever was hoped for. So why wasn't the pre-charging delay litigated? Why wasn't this jurisdictional issue litigated? And why was a plea entered in just with some at least secret understanding that a judge would have to follow it or it would be withdrawn?
I'll split that up, I guess, into two sections because it seems like a very deep question. With regards to the first, talking to one, obviously, Your Honor, as you're aware, as we're standing here before today, this is an issue that really has not been addressed by this court, of the way these statutes work. And despite many attempts by myself to have the legislature hear it, it hasn't been done. So there are a couple of options that exist for a defendant. You advise the defendant of the issue that exists and the possibility that he can seek a remedy. He can file those motions. You talk about it. And you talk about what the possibilities are. And I think Your Honors are all aware everything is very fluid. And when you don't have something concrete, there's a degree of uncertainty there that exists. So you discuss the options, the potential for success, the potential for failure, and where the case goes based on the direction that the jurist agrees with. And so in an instance where these issues would be litigated pre-plea, if they are denied, the state has zero incentive in a case where an individual has written a confession and a letter of apology at age 23 years, of age or 22, I'm sorry if I've got the age wrong, has written that apology. The state has no incentive to offer a negotiation on a case where there's a direct admission to the underlying commission of defense, to which he's now facing life in prison for the possibility of parole at 35. So instead, in a professional circumstance, with a professional deputy district attorney, as existed with the underlying negotiation in this case, you can be open, you can have that discussion with them about those issues, and you can discuss the possibility of success and the possibility of failure. And rather than spend six figures of money that a client doesn't have to litigate the issues, you can work to try and structure a negotiation that mimics the exact punishment that would exist in a juvenile court. The juvenile court statutes dictate 3 years supervision, reporting as a sex offender, and the ability to seal at 30 years of age, which is exactly what was contemplated in this guilty plea, a sex offense with probation.
And an understanding that a judge can give whatever they want within the statute, and a non-negotiation for an ability to withdraw the plea if the judge does not want to give that sentence.
Well, and that's where the conversation becomes interesting, because it really is an issue that hasn't necessarily been interpreted by this court. And I would actually point this court.
But you recognize that by choosing what you did, and I get that there you're choosing between various evils sometimes, you don't preserve that issue for appeal. And then at sentencing, I think even you made the comment that we waive the jurisdictional challenges by deciding to go this route. And here we are now with the jurisdictional challenge.
Well, I don't believe I said that we waived the jurisdictional challenge. In fact, I said
that quote, that's essentially what we tried to structure here as well at the adult level, waiving any of the jurisdictional arguments.
Okay. It may have been a misstatement of words.
Well, the plea agreement says that you're waiving, including any challenge based upon reasonable constitutional, jurisdictional, or other grounds.
And that's understood, but some rights are not waivable. This court has clearly held that subject matter jurisdiction is a non-waivable situation. And even if we are removing some of the contractual issues and inserting the discretion of the court, we're assuming arguendo that that's where your honors are going, jurisdictional issues still exist. There must be subject matter jurisdiction for that to occur. And that's exactly what Kent versus the United States says as well. If waiver is inappropriate or improper, then that case should be dismissed as well. In this circumstance, I mean, in this court has held in a variety of civil situations where those same waivers, in quotes, have been granted, that jurisdiction is of a subject matter nature is not waivable. Walker versus Walker. It's a family court case. A decree is done. When the decree is done, the parties assent to jurisdiction. Post-decree, a subject matter jurisdiction motion is filed to dump it, and this court agrees. In that case, the subject matter can be waived for the first time on appeal. And so if we're looking at it from a strategic standpoint, quite frankly, the issue is not going to go away because the law seems to imply that we can bring that forward at any time. And if the negotiation is followed, then there's no need. And I think the district attorney understood those risks.
But even if the negotiation was followed, the person still has a conviction at that point. I mean, for what you're saying here is they're not even subject to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. So that it shouldn't have happened. So how is that a win?
Because at the end of the day, if the negotiation is followed, the record is sealed and doesn't exist. Because part of the deal that was specifically contemplated is that the state would stipulate to the sealing of the record. And I think that's my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Rob Stevens. I'm a Chief Deputy District Attorney with the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I'm currently assigned to the SVU team. With me today, I just wanted to point out Ms. Bridget Duffy is present outside of the bar today, but present in the courtroom. She is our lead attorney for the juvenile jurisdiction cases of the District Attorney's Office. And if you have specific questions about jurisdictional issues regarding juveniles, I did not want to mislead the court, so she has agreed to come and answer any specific questions about juvenile jurisdiction. Your honors have already picked up on the fact that through negotiations, you can waive rights. You can waive appellate rights. You can waive jurisdictional rights. You can waive speedy trial rights. That's what happened in this particular case. In this particular case, the defendant pled guilty, at which time he waived his challenges to constitutional and jurisdictional grounds. That's in the GPA guilty plea agreement itself and was also canvassed on those things. So his right to appeal has been waived. And for that purpose, I don't believe we should even be here today. In fact, it would be the defendant for filing this appeal that has violated the guilty plea agreement. As for the jurisdictional grounds, that's where a lot of the argument has been spent. In this particular case, again, the defendant waived those jurisdictional grounds in the guilty plea agreement itself and also through a canvas. And I would also argue that the defendant has kind of implied jurisdiction or has kind of waived that jurisdiction just by accepting a negotiation and not challenging it in the district court itself.
Counsel, let's just to make it more interesting. Let's divorce ourselves from the facts here.
Yes.
So what I understand the district court to have said is it's not 16 to 18. He's now over 21. There doesn't seem to be a fit here. So either nobody has jurisdiction or somebody must. And if somebody must, it must be the district court. Is that kind of how you read what the district court did? And if that's the case, is that okay? Is what my question is.
Yes, Your Honor, that's a pretty good summary of how I see the district court ruling in this particular case, and I believe that is an accurate statement. In the Barron decision, it's a 2012 decision, actually written by Justice Hardesty himself, who's with us today. In that particular case, this is on page 343, I'll read this quote. Additionally, many courts have held that the jurisdiction of the juvenile court does not depend on the defendant's age at the time the criminal act was committed, but on his age at the time the proceedings were initiated. He then goes on to state that there has to be jurisdiction at some point. Jurisdiction must exist.
Well, that's my question. Does it have to exist? Does there have to be a court that has jurisdiction, or can there be some things that are just either by age or statute or legislative fiat outside of that, or a mistake? I mean, that's a question.
Yes, Your Honor. The Nevada Constitution states that the district courts are the courts of general original jurisdiction. And so within the juvenile courts themselves, they are limited jurisdiction designed through statutes. And so if there is not a specific statute related to juvenile jurisdiction, then it must be with the district courts. And so jurisdiction must exist somewhere. And so I believe through the Nevada Constitution that this was the proper venue in which to have jurisdiction, because the defendant was 21 at the time that these charges were finally brought.
But don't the way those statutes read, as Mr. Sheets was pointing out, it's different if you're 16, 17, under 18 versus being a 14-year-old. It almost seems to create a statute of limitations for juvenile court that if you're at 21, then it's over, regardless of whether a crime was committed. Just like if you commit a crime that would be an adult crime in district court and it doesn't get followed up on within the time period the statute runs, and maybe people are upset about it, but there's nothing to do.
So that could be an interpretation. I don't personally agree with that interpretation, because that incentivizes or creates a possibility, maybe incentivizing isn't the right word, but creates a possibility where individuals could commit heinous crimes at the age of 15, flee for 6 years or run or hide or do whatever it is, avoid capture. And if they hit the age of 21, then somehow there's nothing that can be done to these individuals. As
maybe that's not the case if they would have been charged.
And that's a good point also. In this particular case, I think that's a little bit tricky, because the defendant himself leaves the country, and I believe voluntarily, leaves the country with his family at the age of 14. And it's after he leaves the country that these things kind of get reported. And so from there, there's not a whole lot that law enforcement can do in order to attain a 14-year-old from a foreign country to have him back.
They had plenty of time to get a warrant after he came back, and they knew he was back. Come on.
Yeah, so in 2019, when the case is reopened again, that's correct, Your Honor, that at that point there could have been efforts made.
My problem with this case is, what did he commit? The statutes provide that he committed a delinquent act, not a crime. And there's a vast difference between the two. So how does a criminal court get access to, how does it have subject matter jurisdiction over a delinquent act committed years before? I get your argument about a purposeful absenting oneself from the jurisdiction, but that's a whole different set of issues, and none of that was briefed here. The issue here has to do with whether or not we've got a hole, basically, that a person commits a delinquent act, isn't taken into custody until they're an adult, and now is now being faced with adult consequences.
So in these particular...
So, I mean, we have to focus, I think, on what is the act that the individual committed. Did they commit a crime, or did they commit a delinquent act? What do you say to that?
I could see how this court would deem that as a possibly a delinquent act because of how the statutes are written, 62B specifically. That entire chapter discusses that. But while it's clear as to when exclusive jurisdiction is not within the juvenile courts, it is silent as to this particular issue. And if it's silent to this issue, then that means that the district courts must have the jurisdiction. So I think what you're trying to say is that this should be deemed a delinquent act, and therefore it must be prosecuted must be prosecuted in the juvenile arena. And in this particular case, there are methods in which youths, juveniles, can be certified up into that adult court. And in this case, where the defendant leaves the jurisdiction.
There is no certification here. There's a lot, that, as you well know, there's quite a bit of evaluation that takes place before a defendant who's going to be a delinquent, who's going to be certified, gets to adult court. The thing that concerns me, and maybe this is more pragmatic than anything else, but if, as you contend, the adult criminal court has jurisdiction in this case, why does the adult criminal court get to assess adult consequences as opposed to juvenile consequences?
Wonderful questions.
I mean, an adult court couldn't do many of the things that the statutes afford to the juvenile court to do. And that's a big distinction. But instead, this person is subject to life imprisonment. That penalty wasn't in existence for this act as a juvenile.
Yeah, where the parties are currently left is the situation where, because of his age, at the time the filing is made, he's 21. And so the parties have used their discretion, and the district attorney's office specifically attempted very diligently to negotiate this in a manner that would treat it as a juvenile court. But because he's 21, unfortunately, there's just no jurisdiction within that juvenile court. That's kind of the end of the story.
That's the problem. One other thing I'd like to ask you about, Steve, is to circle back to the effect of Mr. Sheets' comment and the plea agreement's waiver of jurisdictional challenge. I'm not so sure that our court allows for that. I think we've said in Colwell, Hood, Ogawa, that a subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable. Do you agree with that or not?
I do believe that parties can waive that right through negotiations. I do believe that. Because again, part of the reason we are pursuing negotiations in all sorts of cases, civil and criminal cases, is we're trying to reach a resolution that's final and appropriate. And so when we have reached these negotiations and the parties agree to waive that right, I do believe that that is a right that can be waived. I think it's important to note that these issues could have been raised in the district court and were not, which again then presents us with the situation where we're currently now in, which is there's not really a remedy that can be pursued in the Nevada Supreme Court to justify that jurisdictional issue. It can be potentially remanded back to determine jurisdiction, but we're stuck still with the situation of that's a decision that needs to be made at the lower level where there can be evidentiary hearings.
You're saying this court can't determine that the district court lacks subject matter jurisdiction?
You can do that. What I'm saying is that the remedy of that would simply be a dismissal where we haven't had an opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing as to determine what those facts may be to support or not support those decisions.
Well, is there really a dispute about the age of the individual during the time the delinquent acts were committed versus what the statute says about whether it's a delinquent act versus a crime? And what facts need to be developed here to determine subject matter jurisdiction beyond what we already know?
The age of the defendant is important, both at the time that the act is committed, but also at the time that a complaint is filed. Both of those are important. And then now you are left with the balancing opportunities of, does it go back to the juvenile court to require certification? Or maybe because he's 21, there's no jurisdiction at all within the juvenile court, which would leave us then back to the district court. Or the other option is simply that the district court is the one that has original jurisdiction over this person.
So I have one other aspect of this that's of concern to me. What authority does the adult court have to impose a life sentence, for example, on someone who commits a delinquent act?
That would be
if the judge gets this plea agreement.
Yep.
And now the judge is looking at the underlying criminal facts, the facts that lead to the alleged crime. And it's pointed out to him that notwithstanding the waiver of jurisdiction, we're submitting to you these offenses. How does the judge get to imposing adult penalties for a delinquent act that the defendant has said, go ahead and sentence me, but here's the structure we've agreed to.
So you're asking, how does the court, is it legal to oppose?
That's right.
Okay. Your Honor, that would again go back to, again, whether or not the, and I hate to keep bringing this up, but I think it's important, the juvenile courts have limited jurisdiction. And so if it does not fall within the juvenile jurisdiction of the courts, which because he's 21, it does not, then these are no longer considered delinquent acts under that statute because those statutes don't apply, which then leaves us to where he's 21 and the adult court is now assessing the situation under the adult court rules and under the statute. It was a potential agreement of potential 2 to 20 years, as the court knows.
You got a case that supports that an offense committed by a juvenile at age 14 becomes an adult crime if captured at 22?
I don't have a case to support that. What I do have, though, Your Honor, is the
you're arguing by default, it sounds like. Some court must have jurisdiction. Why isn't the opposite also true? The imposition of the determination of offenses is statutory, and the courts who have jurisdiction to impose consequences for those offenses is also statutory. Why shouldn't we follow the statutory constructs? I mean, where do we get the idea that if one doesn't work, then the other one must follow?
Yeah, that comes from the Barron decision, Your Honor, where some court must have jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And so if it's not the juvenile court, then by default, as you said, it must be that.
So that takes me to the other question I had before, which is even if it has jurisdiction, how can it impose adult-related penalties? How do we get there?
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? Because the act committed is a delinquent act. It's not a crime. Accepting that all of these things occurred at age 14 or younger.
Yes, and we don't dispute those facts.
Yeah.
I think the where I dispute or disagree with your
argument. Even if the adult court has jurisdiction.
Yes.
To impose something for a delinquent act, I don't know that it gets to being able to impose adult sentencing responses.
That's a fair opinion to have. I personally disagree with that. I think.
So how do we get to your position?
What was that, sorry?
How do I get to your position?
To get to my position, Your Honor, is because the juvenile court does not have the jurisdiction, there's no such thing as a delinquent act at that point. Those are constructed by statute. And because those statutes no longer apply when you're 21, then we are left simply with what the general crimes and statutes say. And under this particular case, it's treated as a potential life sentence should he be convicted. Here we've reached a negotiation that was not followed by the courts. With that, Your Honor, I believe my time, oh, yes.
Well, let's see if other justices have any other
yes,
questions.
I did. It's okay. Yeah. The language of the plea agreement is that the state wasn't going to oppose probation, among other things, but it didn't appear to me to be conditional at all. It was Clark Newberry, right?
It was.
Does she take conditional pleas, or was that not part of your negotiation?
It was not part of the negotiation in this case. As for specifically with Judge Newberry, Your Honor, I don't know for sure whether she does or does not. It's my experience, though, that every single district court judge is open to the possibility of conditional pleas.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but okay.
Yeah, I personally haven't done a conditional plea in front of her, so that's where I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Were there other questions of the justices? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. I don't mean to beat up on you. It's a very interesting case, but I was very interested in understanding how you arrive at your position.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Hellman, I guess we get to hear from you.
And if I could just request the additional time that Mr. Stevens was granted to go over, if I could just have that added to my rebuttal.
I'll give you an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you. So as the justices have heard, and as I think is very clear in this case, we have an issue with the subject matter jurisdiction. And it's clearly established law that that can never be waived. We have cases like Colwell. We have cases like Wilson. And even though the guilty plea agreement in that subsection 6 of the waiver of rights does say that the defendant is waiving by entering this plea certain constitutional jurisdictional grounds, it actually cites NRS 177.015 subsection 4, which provides that there is the right to appeal reasonable constitutional jurisdictional or other grounds challenging the legality of this proceeding.
So should you all were on Sunseri, weren't you?
Yes.
Right. So should this, and I know you all weren't the primary attorneys in Sunseri. You were the ones that I believe raising on appeal the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So does this, is this more about ineffective assistance of counsel potentially? And I hate to put you on the spot in that regard versus, hey, we have a waiver verbally on the record. We have a waiver and a plea agreement. Should this come up in an IAC claim instead?
And respectively, I don't think that this is necessarily an IAC claim because we are dealing with something that does not have clearly established law as applied to Mr. Zowel's specific case. So in the district court proceedings and the justice court proceedings, we are making advice, giving advice to our client about potential issues, potential consequences, strategies. We don't know where the district court is going to rule on this jurisdictional issue if we raise it then. So rather than risk that at trial, we do craft a negotiation with the state that would treat this as a delinquent act, which is what it has always been and always would be. So I don't believe it's necessarily an IAC issue, though I think that could be raised ultimately depending on how things resolve. But I don't believe it's clearly that issue. I think this is still appropriate for a direct appeal based on the jurisdictional issue. And I think ultimately, because this is always a delinquent act, what we would be allowing the state to do is essentially take what is a delinquent act for someone who's 14, allow the state to delay the prosecution as was done here because they do know where he is. They could have issued a writ of attachment while he was a juvenile and then proceed to prosecute him after he's 21 when it would now be in the adult court and essentially create an ex post facto issue where now the consequences are so significantly different than what would have been afforded to him if he were prosecuted as a juvenile or adjudicated delinquent as a juvenile. Because again, this has always been a delinquent act. And there is a process or there is a procedure to analyze the process for an adult who committed a delinquent act. Some of our case law addresses that, such as Kent, the analysis there. And I believe that's my time.
Any questions for Ms. Hyman?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you all counsel for your excellent arguments this morning. Really appreciate your input on a challenging question. Once again, we're trying to interpret statutes and for all of us, it becomes a challenge. I really appreciate it. The case will stand submitted, and the court will stay on the bench and wait for counsel for the Peters case to come forward.